Samaveta Bhakti Vrindiki Jai. All glories to the Assembled Devotees. All glories to the Assembled Devotees. All glories to the Assembled Devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritam Naram Chaivam Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Datho Jaya Mudirayat Nastapra Yeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shlokir Bhakti Bhavati Naishtaki. A reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translations and purports by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Fifth canto, 14th chapter, text number 7. Kvachit. Shashesha dosha. Nishadanam Purisha Vishesham Tad. Varna Guna Nirmita Mati Suvarnam Upaditsati Agni Kama Katara Ivomukha Pishacham Pachit Chate Sadosha Nishidanam Puri Shavishesham Tadvarna Guna Nirmita Mati Suvarnam Upadisati Agni Kama Katsara Ivalmukha Pisharam, Pisacham Agni Kama Katara Ivalmukha Pisacham Pachicha Shesha Dosa Nisidanam Purisha Vishesham Tadvarna Guna Nimitamati Suvarnam Upadisati Agni Kama Katara Ivamukha Pishacham Vachit. Sometimes. Sha. Also. Ashesha. Unlimited. Dosha. Of fault. Ishadanam. The source of. Purisha. Of stool. Vishesham. A particular type. Tatvaranaguna. Whose color is the same as that of the mode of passion. Reddish. Nirmita Mati, whose mind is absorbed in that. Suvarnam,
gold.
Upadisati, desiring to get. Agnikama, by the desire for fire. Taturaha, who is troubled. Eva, like. Ulmukha, Hisacham, a phosphorescent light known as the will-o'-the-wisp, which is sometimes mistaken for a ghost. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Sometimes the living entity is interested in the yellow stool known as gold and runs after it. That gold is the source of material opulence and envy, and it can enable one to afford illicit sex, gambling, meat-eating, and intoxication. Those whose minds are overcome by the motive passion are attracted by the color of gold, just as a man suffering from cold in the forest runs after a phosphorescent light in a marshy land, considering it to be fire. Just read responsively. Sometimes the living entity is interested in the yellow stool known as gold and runs after it. The gold is the source of material opulence and envy, and it can enable one to afford illicit sex, gambling, meat-eating, and intoxication. Those whose minds are overcome by the motive passion are attracted by the color of gold, just as a man suffering from cold in the forest runs after a phosphorescent light in a marshy land, considering it to be fire. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Parikshit Maharaj told Kali Yuga to leave his kingdom immediately and reside in four places: brothels, liquor shops, slaughterhouses, and gambling casinos. However, Kali Yuga requested him to give him only one place where these four places are included, and Parikshit Maharaj gave him the place where gold is stored. Gold encompasses the four principles of sin, and therefore, according to spiritual life, gold should be avoided as far as possible. If there is gold, there is certainly illicit sex, meat-eating, gambling, and intoxication. Because people in the Western world have a great deal of gold, they are victims of these four sins. The color of gold is very glittering, and a materialistic person becomes very much attracted by its yellow color. However, this gold is actually a type of stool. A person with a bad liver generally passes yellow stool. The color of this stool attracts a materialistic person, just as the will-o'-the-wisp attracts one who needs heat. Om agyanati minatya anjana salakaya chaksurumritam jena tasmai shudravena maha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam stapiram yena bhutale svayam rupakadamayam purati svaparantikam. Sometimes the Srimad Bhagavatam uses very, what Prabhupada calls, harsh words. There's another passage where human beings are compared to animals, Svavidvara Hostra Karai, Sangsita Purusha Pashu, Nayat Karna Patopeto, Chatu Nama Gadagraja. People who do not glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead are considered to be like hogs, dogs, camels, and asses. They have no taste for spiritual life, and therefore they cannot be considered human beings. So they are on this category. Gold is very much sought after by the materialists. And as it's mentioned here, it's very glittering. It has a very attractive color. Prabhupada mentions gambling casinos here. There's a big gold statue out in front of a big famous gambling casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, called Caesar's Palace. And that statue is a statue of Lord Brahma, life-size, with four heads, probably imported from Thailand or India or someplace. And it's out there day and night. Because people are very attracted. They're attracted to the yellow color, they're attracted to the glistening and the glimmering day and night of the gold. So the Bhagavatam compares this to yellow stool with its very noxious smell. It's very attractive. People give their lives to accumulate gold. And yet, according to spiritual vision, it has a very repulsive side to it. Just as we would be very revolted to see or smell yellow stool as it's coming from a diseased person. It's bad enough as it is, but particularly yellow stool is mentioned. It's very particularly obnoxious. Gold, therefore, has its very bad side, so much so that all of the, as Prabhupada says here, all of the sinful activities that exist, the four sinful activities, are encompassed by gold. Wherever there is gold, he says, there will surely be illicit sex, gambling, intoxication, and meat eating. This is actually the case. When Maharaj Parikshit decided to banish Kali, he banished him to the place where there would be gold, and only gold, because everything else would automatically be included. In the Western world, there is a large accumulation of gold. It's said that in Fort Knox, in the treasury of the United States, there are huge masses of gold bars stacked up like this. People identify with this gold and opulence, and they are ready to give their lives for it. During the Depression in America, around about 1933, there was a great realization by many people. There's a famous story of a man, there was probably more than one, but there was one for sure, who was a stockbroker. And when the market crashed, he was in his skyscraper in Wall Street in New York, and he dived out the window to his death. This became a very famous incident. When someone is so attached to and identifies himself with wealth, then one is willing to die for it. And people do, they do die for this gold. There were prospectors who came to the United States in the late 19th century. They called it the California Gold Rush. And many people actually died looking for gold. It was not uncommon to find people living in the mountains of Northern California in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, still who had not found a single ounce of gold hardly, and were still panning the waters to find their gold and dying up there as unsuccessful prospectors. There's also a lot of gold in Brazil. Prabhupada mentioned once that the gold that had been amassed by Ravana was actually taken from Brazil. According to what Prabhupada said, he burrowed a tunnel under the surface of the earth round from Sri Lanka to Ceylon, then called. I guess it was Sri Lanka, then Ceylon, and now Sri Lanka again, to Brazil. And through this tunnel, he exhumed all this gold. He had a brother, apparently, who lived in Brazil, and he brought all this gold back to build his great kingdom of gold. So imagine the difficulty it requires to do something like that. And still, in Brazil, gold is being mined in the mountains, in the streams, in the Amazon. There are barges in the Amazon River, some of the most dangerous parts of the Amazon, very swift currents. And divers go down in their diving helmets, way down hundreds of meters into the water to find gold. And sometimes the competing barge from another country, another company, will have its agent come along and snips the man's air cord, and then dies a very excruciating death down there with the pressure. And little towns spring up still in these shanty town areas of Brazil off the Amazon, where the prospectors live. And in these little shanty towns, you can see it exactly as it's mentioned in the Bhagavatam. All these four principles exist. They're very small. They're just the gold prospectors, maybe a few hundred population. And what do they have there? They have brothels, they have liquor shops, they have butcher shops, and they're constantly getting drunk, and they're constantly gambling, constantly, just for this gold. And out of all the people who are there, most of them are just trudging up these slopes, these very muddy slopes, with their gold on their backs, the native workers. And they get a few, just a little pittance, a few coins, and the entrepreneurs are there just making millions and millions of dollars. So there are just a few getting very rich, and the rest are getting nowhere, really. So Prabhupada, in the Bhagavatam, in the first canto, recommends that there be a gold standard. There was a gold standard at one time. And then there was a silver standard after that. And now there's what's called an international money unit, IMU, they call it, because the currency trade is very global. So these IMUs are calculated every day, the currencies through the money markets, their value, their standard value. But these are the real, so-called real wealth of the world, these IMUs, because if you tried to get silver or gold or any metal, any precious metal, for all the paper currency that exists nowadays, you might get 1 or 2% back. So it's a completely artificial situation. And even more artificial is the international money units, which are nothing more than computer impulses on disks, that little tiny, almost invisible, small electronic impulses you can't even see. That's where the wealth of the world has now resided or come to. So there is no real wealth in that sense. Therefore, Prabhupada, in his purports in the Bhagavatam, recommends that the gold standard should be reestablished so that at least there would be some reality to the situation. And as in Vedic times, people didn't even use coins very much. They bartered things. And if they did trade, they used the gold coins. Actually, he mentioned that even the poorest people in India would not be so poor, because they would have utensils that were golden, especially in prior times. If they became poor, they would just trade in their golden utensils for something else. Even today, although India is considered a poor country, if you took all the gold that is there in the form of jewelry, bangles and earrings and rings and all those things, you'd find it's not a poor country at all. So I'm just going to read a short section from the first canto of the Bhagavatam, which Prabhupada refers to here, where Maharaj Parikit tells Kali to leave his kingdom and reside in a place where the sinful activities take place. First of all, Maharaj Parikit, being petitioned by the personality of Kali, gave him permission to reside in places where gambling, drinking, prostitution, and animal slaughter were performed. Then Prabhupada comments, "The basic principles of irreligiosity, such as pride, prostitution, intoxication, and falsehood, counteract the four principles of religion, namely austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. The personality of Kali was given permission to live in four places particularly mentioned by the king, namely the place of gambling, the place of prostitution, the place of drinking, and the place of animal slaughter." Then in the next verse, verse 40, Suta Goswami continues, "The personality of Kali asked for something more, and because of his begging, the king gave him permission to live where there is gold, because wherever there is gold, there is also falsity, intoxication, lust, envy, and enmity." And this is Prabhupada's purport. Although Maharaj Parikit gave Kali permission to live in four places, it was very difficult for him to find the places. During the reign of Maharaj Parikit, there were no such places. Therefore, Kali asked the king to give him something practical which could be utilized for his nefarious purposes. Maharaj Parikit thus gave him permission to live in a place where there is gold, because wherever there is gold, there are all the above mentioned four things. And over and above them, there is enmity. So the personality of Kali became gold standardized. According to Srimad Bhagavatam, gold encourages falsity, intoxication, prostitution, envy, and enmity. Even a gold standard exchange and currency is bad. Gold standard currency is based on falsehood because the currency is not on par with the reserved gold. The basic principle is falsity because currency notes are issued in value beyond that of the actual reserved gold. The artificial inflation of currency by the authorities encourages prostitution of the state economy. The price of commodities becomes artificially inflated because of bad money or artificial currency notes. Bad money drives away good money. Instead of paper currency, actual gold coins should be used for exchange, and this will stop prostitution of gold. Gold ornaments for women may be allowed by control, not by quality, but by quantity. This will discourage lust, envy, and enmity. When there is actual gold currency in the form of coins, the influence of gold in producing falsity, prostitution, etc. will automatically cease. There will be no need of an anti-corruption ministry for another term of prostitution and falsity of purpose. So, and then Prabhupada continues. Thus the personality, next verse, verse 41. Thus the personality of Kali by the direction of Maharaj Parikit, the son of Uttara, was allowed to live in those five places. And Prabhupada comments in his purport to that verse. Thus, the age of Kali began with gold standardization, and therefore falsity, intoxication, animal slaughter, and prostitution are rampant all over the world, and the saner section is eager to drive out corruption. The counteracting process is suggested above, and everyone can take advantage of this suggestion. So Prabhupada was giving some practical advice. In another section of the Bhagavatam, he also advises that the death penalty be prescribed for offenders who are taking intoxication and thieves. This practice still exists in some Muslim countries. They cut off their arms and hands if they steal. From the Manusamhita we hear that's a very effective deterrent for thievery. He also recommends that there be compulsory fasting from grains twice a month. This will increase health and save millions of dollars in grains, he says. Very practical thing. And boys and girls should be married young when the girls reach puberty, when the men are also very young, so that the tendency towards libertinism and illicit sex and prostitution will be curbed. And he also recommends strict control over all forms of intoxication, just as was done during the reign of Maharaj Parikit. So these are very practical things which Prabhupada is recommending for governments of the age, of the day. And surely, at least we hope, as Lord Chaitanya's movement grows and spreads throughout the world, some of these plans will be implemented. Wealth is a great deterrent for spiritual life. We see in Bharat, the former Bharat, the land of India, spirituality is still a prevailing force. Although the invasion of the so-called Western culture, I call it the meat culture, is rapidly taking hold and causing the Vedic culture to reverse. Now you will see satellite dishes on the tops of the slum buildings, television aerials sticking out of the hutments, all these little slum huts all over India. And the great erosion is taking place very rapidly. But still, there is a sense of eternity, and 80% of or so of the population still live in a somewhat rural environment. So it's poor by Western standards. And as Prabhupada particularly indicates here in the Western world, the Western countries, people are very enamored. And it's very difficult for them to understand spiritual life. It is like a disease. Like the higher temperature is a symptom of an unhealthy body. So wealth is like that. Opulence is like a disease. And it's like a fortress around the living entity, the human entity. This fortress or this wall makes it very difficult for spiritual thought, spiritual teaching, spiritual ideas to penetrate. Queen Kunti says that Janmaishwarya Shruti Shribir Evdak Mana Madak Puman Naivarhat Yavidatumbai Tvama Kinchana Gochara. My Lord, you are very easy to approach, but only by those who are materially exhausted, those who are on the path of material progress. One who is on the path of material progress, trying to improve himself by great education, personal beauty, noble parentage, and great opulence, cannot approach you with sincere feeling. So there's a quality in the utterance of the holy name, there's a quality in the seva one performs for Krishna, and it's based on the fact of being materially exhausted. Materially exhausted doesn't mean that one is necessarily poor by economic standards. Materially exhausted means that one has developed a healthy sense of cynicism about material wealth, about gold, opulence, beauty, education, nobility. These things are all stumbling blocks on the path. Therefore, the Pandavas, they were very happy in one sense to be bereft of a kingdom, because they felt very close to Krishna, and Krishna felt very close to them. He deigned to give them personal association because they were very strong in their spiritual consciousness, even though they were bereft of a kingdom which all Kshatriyas had a right to. It's also said, Krishna says himself in the Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, Bhogaishwarya Prasaktanam Taya Prakrita Chetasam Vyavasayat Nikabudir Samado Navidiyate. But for one who is surrounded by wealth and opulence and who is bewildered by such things, a single-minded devotion, Vyavasayat Nikabudir, does not take place in the heart. Or it's said in Christian literature that it's more difficult for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go to heaven. Very difficult. So we can see spiritual life diminished. Particularly in the Western countries, it's said that between America, Canada, Australia, Northern Europe, and Japan, something like 40 or 50% of all the energy of the world is consumed. And these countries are not even maybe a fourth or the fifth of the whole population of the world. There's very great appetite for increasing material wealth, and it becomes stronger and stronger. It's a form of material desire that just increases and increases and increases. So gold is very, very attracting, very alluring. Sometimes we see it even printed on a page. They have books that have gold letters, gold ink. There's gold ink you can get. You can get clothes with gold in them, gold saris, gold dhotis. People are very fond of covering them. Sometimes you see these people with rings on all four fingers, gold. I visited the Tirupati temple once. This is a very wealthy temple in South India near Madras, where people go to see Lord Venkateshwar, the form of Lord Vishnu, a big self-manifesting deity, stands about 6-7 feet high. And every day there's a huge queue of people to go see him. They say 20,000 people a day go to see this Lord Balaji, or Venkateshwar as he's called. And when we were going up to see this deity, we had to wait about 6 hours. There's so many people. And even paying 20 rupees, you have to wait 6 hours. If you pay more, maybe you can wait 1 hour. Anyway, we snaked up this long path around and around the temple, upstairs, across balconies, down passageways, through hallways, outside, inside, and finally we came around to the entrance. And as we came around to the entrance, there was a big burlap carpet, red color, just a real red carpet. And across the top of this red burlap carpet trickles a little stream of water so that all the pilgrims' feet become automatically washed as you walk up this incline, red carpet. And then you walk and walk up about 20, 30 yards, and the water stops, and then you're walking on dry burlap, and then a little further, you're all dried off. And then the big queue, which is about 15 people wide in the beginning, narrows down and narrows down. There are ropes until you're single file, and there are guards telling you to be sure not to take any pictures. And
you see these big golden stupas inside. At least they're gold covered. And as you get closer and closer to the deity, you go up some stairs, you go around some more corners. We could hear this sound, that it was a kind of thrashing sound. And none of us in our party could understand what it was. We couldn't work it out. We were just trying to imagine what it was. And I thought maybe there was some kind of metal fan they were using to fan the deity. It was going like that. So as we finally got up to the inner sanctum where the deity is at the far end, we saw what the sound was. There were about 20 men with big iron sieves shaking coins back and forth through little holes. And another 20 men were picking up the coins and wrapping them up and packing them according to, you know, what their denomination was, different sizes of half rupees and 50 pice and rupee coins and so on. So that's what the sound was. And there was another four or five men that were folding notes and stacking them and wrapping them up. So there's this whole menagerie of Brahmins or whatever they were, counting money. So you go down this long passageway to see the deity, and if you're lucky, you might get 1 or 2 seconds of darshan. Because we were white people, unusual, they let us have about 30 or 40 seconds. And then we walked around to the back, and around the back, over on the side, is this huge hundi. It's a big, looks like a duffel bag made of cloth with an opening at the top hanging from the roof above, big cloth sack. And everybody who had come through to the deities was putting their wealth inside this big sack. Sometimes people would put in rings, they would put in all kinds of gadgets, and whatever was very expensive. So that's where all these funds were coming from. And it's reputed to be very wealthy. They say that it's so wealthy that the government finally had to take control of this. It's called the Tirupati, what is it? Devasthanam something, trust. Tirumala Tirupati Devasthanam, trust. One of the most interesting things was in the little seating area, the waiting area where we waited before seeing the deity for a long time, we saw about every 10th or 20th person looked very opulent, and they shaved their heads to come. There's a place as you walk up before you go to the temple. There's a 5-story building, about 100 meters long, and there's a big sign that runs the whole length of it. It's actually a barber shop, is what it is. But the sign says, in very large letters, "Place of Surrendering Human Hair to Lord Venkateshwar." And all this hair is sold as to make wigs and for other reasons. I'm not sure what for. But about every 10th person in the queue and inside the waiting room, head was shaved. Even the women, about every 20 or 30 women had their head shaved. They shaved the children. And you'd see people with very opulent hands and arms just covered with gold bangles. And these people would sometimes put their bangles in the hundi after they came around to visit the deity. So it's known commonly there that people surrender their wealth to that deity in order to get some benefit. It's a kind of punya that they hope they will get benefit. So they give their gold to the Lord in hopes that they will get some return. So this is another one of the forms of entrapment of wealth. One thinks that if wealth is given to the deity, that the deity will automatically give benedictions and return it maybe 10 or 15 or 20 times. Of course, Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavatam that if one gives in charity, one will be rewarded equal or more. If one gives to a Brahmin, he will get 4 times return. But if he gives to a Vaishnava, or to the cause of a Vaishnava, or to the cause of Vishnu, his return, Prabhupada writes, will come by unlimited multiplication. So wealth engaged in the service of Krishna, actually in the service of Vishnu or Krishna, is a very great thing. Whereas wealth which is meant for hoarding or for one's own personal use has just the opposite effect. And the nice metaphors are used here. One who is very cold will think that the glittering light in the marshes will save him. One of the flights I was on showed some little movie. They called it Nature's Neon. It was about all the little animals that live in the marshes and swamps that have, like the fireflies, that have little lights. So any kind of light is very attractive. Gold is part of this light and glittering effect, and people are very attracted to it. It's part of Maya's intelligence. Maya's the great agent for packaging things. Sometimes I use this example of the skin. Lord Chaitanya has very beautiful golden skin. And Radharani's complexion is also golden, spiritually golden. But and that's yoga maya. But Mahamaya also makes skin very attractive. And even though beneath the skin it's only blood and bone and very uninteresting, revolting aspects of a body, all these different liquids. And yet, when covered by beautiful human body, beautiful complexion, then it becomes irresistibly attractive. So much so that people are bound to the material world life after life after life to enjoy the company or the sight of the opposite sex. And to just look below that little membrane, that little layer that's a fraction of the bodily weight, one is so revolted he can't even look at it. People always get sick to their stomach when they see it in an surgical operation the first time. So this is how we are kept in this material world. Maya is arranging so many things, so many glittering things. The Goswamis have also trained us or taught us that if their teaching is to spread, then we must know how to engage even those things which are deceitfully alluring under Maya's power in the service of Krishna. Sanatana and Rupa were ordered by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to benefit and benedict the whole world by excavating the holy sites in Vrindavan, by writing voluminous literatures based on the teachings he gave them, and by undergoing austerities and staying in Vrindavan. And his instruction was that if you carry out these orders, you will benefit the future of the whole world. So they weren't just bhajan nandis living in caves and under trees and around the sacred ponds, but they had a purpose. And Lord Chaitanya told them what that purpose was. So Rupa Goswami has told us, anasaktasya vishayam yataham upayunjitaha krishna sambandha vigana yuktam vairagyam uchite and prapanjikataya buddha hari sambandhu vatsanai mumukshu viparityago vairagya phago satyate, that one should not be attached to anything but be attached to everything in relationship with Krishna, then he is rightly situated above possessiveness. On the other hand, if he tries to reject everything not knowing its relationship to Krishna, he's imperfect in his renunciation. This was the standard set by Rupa Goswami and followed by our sampradaya, that even the great goal can be used in the service of Krishna. Prabhupada once made a joke about one charlatan guru who's very popular, has many followers all over the world, that his mudra was always like this. unfortunate in the material sense, more entangled in that obtain $1 million every day and spend it every day. That would be yuktam vairagya and proper use of wealth. And one sees that this is not only possible but taking place. If wealth is properly engaged in the service of Krishna, then it continues to grow. In the material sense, under Mahamaya, one invests in something and there's some return, and then one becomes more and more entangled in that investment. Then even up into old age, one is completely trapped, wanting to accumulate more and more and more, because the sense of this, of wanting to accumulate, can never be satisfied. It can only increase. And no matter how much gold or wealth one amasses, one will still never feel satisfied. And if we carefully analyze those who have been fortunate in the material sense to become wealthy, they're never satisfied, because there's always someone with a bigger house, a bigger business. There's always more land to get. If I don't have a big enough piece of land, I want to buy an island. And if I don't have a big enough island, I want to buy a country. And then if I have the country, then I want to be famous. So wealth leads to wanting fame. If one is famous, one wants wealth. I had a relative, I think they're still alive actually, very wealthy people, and they live in Beverly Hills. So when they came to New York to visit me, I was a starving musician in those days. They wanted to sort of take me out and impress me, take me out in the town. And they were very proud of the fact that so many movie stars and famous people lived around them. They were wealthy, but they weren't famous, but they wanted to be famous. So there were some famous people in this restaurant, and they just kind of leaned over the table and said, "Oh, hello, so-and-so," and introduced me to them. You could see that even though they had everything, they still were very unsatisfied because they wanted to be famous. They wanted to rub shoulders with all the famous people. And I could understand them. Here's people, why should they care? But they were still insatiably after fame. They had to go and always and visit their famous television star neighbor. And we always, every time we saw him, they would tell us about what he was doing, what kind of a car he drove, what he ate over at their house, and so on and so on and so forth. So it actually never ends. And even our gross senses are like that. The more we surround ourselves with beauty and wealth, with beautiful stereo, beautiful music, the more we want. Because the more we give, the senses are said to be voracious and uncontrollable. They can never, ever be satisfied. On the other hand, a devotee who expertly handles this opulence and wealth feels completely satisfied. Can be satisfied with everything, or he can be satisfied with nothing. So that's the yuktam vairagyam principle. He has nothing, he feels as satisfied as the person who has everything. There's no bar for someone to join Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada obviously knew that to engage everything and everyone in the service of Krishna would bring with it some risks. But these were the risks that were worth taking. What to speak of the risk of coming to the Western world? What a great risk to come to the most materialistic part of the world and try to spread Krishna consciousness. Actually, at one time, we read in Prabhupada's biography, he more or less gave up. He was in New York, at least on one level. And he was saying to himself that these people, they're breaking all the four regulative principles. If you have ever been in New York or you've heard of this one area called 42nd Street in Midtown Manhattan. There's nothing but brothels, meat eating, every form of intoxication imaginable, and gambling, all happening on, you know, it's just concentrated, very, very concentrated in one street, one block. In fact, there's so much glitter there that you don't even know the difference between day and night hardly. There's so much neon and bright lights with the marquees overhanging the streets. So Prabhupada was saying that these people are so lost in their wealth that they will never come to Krishna consciousness. And he was contemplating returning to India. But of course he was very committed to the orders of his spiritual master and persevered And he was very thrilled to see that Krishna consciousness began, even in such a place. Of course, the people that began Krishna consciousness weren't so materially well off, but still, compared to the standard in India, they were very well off. And he was very thrilled to see that even though his friends in India wouldn't give him any help in any way, that Krishna consciousness, somehow it began to take hold, even in the most affluent country in the world, the most lost and sinful country in the world. Krishna consciousness began with a new flavor, with a new feeling, with a different sense. So he became very happy and preached that, as Rupa Goswami says, everything can be used in the service of Krishna. And Prabhupada took great risks, as we know, to involve very materialistic people and all this great wealth. And so many souls that were initially very inspired became lost. So much of the wealth became lost because there is a very great risk all the time in these kinds of environments. But nonetheless, by the power of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Krishna consciousness began to prevail and spread all over the world. So one of the messages of this verse in the purport is that one has to be very careful in handling opulence and wealth. This is actually one of the reasons why the devotees of Vishnu are generally not very opulent. That question came up to the speaker of the Bhagavatam. And he answered by bringing forward the story of Rikasura. And in that verse, in that chapter, it's mentioned, yasyaham anugranami harishe tadanamshanai, that sometimes, as the first installment of his mercy, Krishna takes away the wealth of the living entity. So the story of Rikasura, as we know, was that he was so greedy for material opulence and power that he wanted to be able to destroy anyone he touched. And he was granted that boon by Lord Shiva, who very easily grants boons. So he immediately tried to kill Lord Shiva. This is the nature of gaining wealth. One can immediately use it for such demonic purposes. And it was only by the intervention of Krishna directly that Lord Shiva was saved. So in this connection, the answer was given that Lord Vishnu will keep his devotees sometimes in poor condition. The tendency is, the question was, why are Lord Shiva's followers tending to be so opulent, those of Lord Vishnu tending to be poor? And this was the answer. Lord Shiva is actually benedicting his followers by keeping them in this condition so that they will not be falsely allured by Maya, that they will be a little bit cautious. And we've seen, as Krishna consciousness spreads, generally, at least at this stage, that the people who come to Krishna consciousness are not so well off. Actually, devotees wanted to set up a temple in Beverly Hills once. This was some time ago, 1971. And Prabhupada's argument against it is that, well, he said the people in Beverly Hills, they were in Los Angeles, the temple was in Watsika, where it is now, and there was a big scheme, some building was available. And Prabhupada said, they're not very interested in Krishna consciousness. You'll have a very difficult time spreading Krishna consciousness in that part of the world. He may have had other reasons, but that was the ostensible reason he gave, that they were so lost in their material wealth. And it's true, we find that if you try to preach Krishna consciousness in the same way to the most affluent people of the world, it will be very difficult for them to understand what Krishna consciousness actually is. Of course, where our headquarters is in Washington, we're in like the Beverly Hills of the west coast of the United States. It's called Potomac, Maryland. The devotees bought this property when the property values were different and it was just a dirt road. And in the last 15 years, it's become extremely opulent. Every house has at least an acre of land around it. So we have to work very hard to try to understand how to reach to these people, because if we do it in the usual way, just to Haryanam up and down Oakland Drive, it would probably have a reverse effect. But it's a great challenge to reach those people who are surrounded by great, great opulence and fame. And one has to be very careful. And it's taking a long time just to really work out how to even do it. But it's a great challenge. Of course, Prabhupada said that we should get such people to preach Krishna consciousness. Whatever a great man does, common people will follow. But ours is a movement of the masses, and through chanting, through prasadam distribution, through visiting our congregation, and through books, through these four things, the Krishna conscious movement has grown exponentially and will certainly continue to grow. Once I got a letter from Prabhupada, and he said that if you can get famous people to preach for you, that is first class. Otherwise, he said, don't waste your time trying to preach to famous people. I was writing letters to the Supreme Court justices in the United States. So that is a great art of preaching, how great affluence can be engaged in the service of Krishna. So I'll read the verse again. Sometimes the living entity is interested in the yellow stool known as gold and runs after it. That gold is the source of material opulence and envy, and it can enable one to afford illicit sex, gambling, meat-eating, and intoxication. Those whose minds are overcome by the mode of passion are attracted by the color of gold, just as a man suffering from gold in the forest runs after a phosphorescent light in a marshy land, considering it to be fire. So, any questions or comments? The principle is detachment. It's like Mars Yudhisthira. When he left his kingdom, all his opulence, you know, very wealthy to be king, courtesans, entertainment, wonderful food, beautiful residential facilities, parks and lakes and gardens. He said he left it behind just like it was stool. After one leaves the filthy place immediately after defecating. So it's like we're reading here. Gold is like that. It's compared to stool. These very, very picturesque metaphors are given in the Bhagavatam. One who has a transcendental vision can see all these surroundings, all this opulence, like that. So he saw it like that. And as Rupa Goswami says, it's not that we try to give everything up and run away from it, but we simply detach ourselves from it. We become detached. That's the principle, the real principle of Yuktam Vairagya. So we are using wealth, we're using paraphernalia, we're using our abilities in the service of Krishna. And in that way they become purified. They cease to be materialistic. They become spiritualized. Just like iron put in a fire becomes red hot and acts just like fire. So its quality of a base cold metal is no longer there. It's just like fire. So the whole process is to spiritualize our existence and spiritualize everything we do. So if our Krishna consciousness is strong through deity worship, through good chanting and reading, we can engage in so many other activities that aren't, you know, in the temple, but as part of the preaching, as part of the expansion of the Krishna consciousness movement. And they'll become purified. And that's Yuktam Vairagya. Prabhupada enshrined Guru Kripa and Yasodhananda's name in the Krishna Balaram temple there. They were doing all kinds of highly questionable things in Japan. But Prabhupada was very pleased with the result. It's not that the means justifies the ends, but still, there is the philosophy and the practice of Yuktam Vairagya and converting matter into spirit. So if we maintain our spiritual purity, we can do this. We can affect the change of matter into spirit and purify our existence and our activities. Well, these kinds of metaphors, this kind of, it's kind of like poetry, we might say, which gives us an impetus to understand that we have to be a bit cynical or pessimistic about material things, and know that from the point of view of the Bhagavatam, they in and of themselves are debilitating or revolting. Sometimes people criticize Prabhupada for using technology. You use airplanes, use dictaphones, use microphones, use computers. Why do you do that? Isn't spiritual life supposed to be simple? And Prabhupada responded by saying that we are the only people that are using technology beneficially. Everybody else is using it to destroy society. They're building bombs. They're polluting the atmosphere. So it's being used in a very adverse way. But when it's used in bhakti yoga, according to Yuktam Vairagya, just the opposite is happening. It's spiritualizing the atmosphere. So it's not that the gold is bad in and of itself. It's how it's used. It's a matter of application. But to give us enthusiasm about not being excited about gold, we have to understand that it's actually very dangerous. And therefore it's said sometimes that spiritual life is like walking a tightrope, or a razor's edge, Prabhupada says. It's like a razor's edge. If we're not Krishna conscious, it becomes gold. It's like the moths are attracted to the flame. That's another good analogy the Bhagavad Gita uses. The living entities are being sucked into the mouths of death by Maya, just as the flies and the moths are sucked into the flame. As soon as they fly into the flame, put, that was the word Prabhupada used, finished by the glitter of the light, and their lives are just destroyed instantly. So the glitter is like that. It's like death in a sense. So we have to understand there's a revolting side to all of the attractive things of nature. And if we keep that in mind, it will help us guard our consciousness against being falsely allured. Devotees, as they develop, they begin to see the spiritual world everywhere, so they don't look disdainfully. They're very joyful. Krishna conscious, Rajaguyam, Rajaguyam, Rajavijam, Pavitramidam Uttamam, Patyaksha Vagamam Guyam. It's a joyful experience. It's actually joyful. But still, even one who is very joyful will understand that that's dangerous, and we'll very skillfully sidestep the dangers of Maya. We're happy because we know how to do that little sidestep. We know how to avoid being deceitfully allured into something that will injure us. Well, it definitely represents the beginning of the age of Kali. He's representing the fact that there will be so many more. He's said to be the personality of Kali. He's obviously some kind of jiva, living entity, but he represents the beginning. Just like when Sringi, the son of Shamaka Rishi, cursed the king, it was very uncommon for a king, a kshatriya, to become thirsty and hungry, but he didn't. He came into the cave. And it was also not customary for him to feel, act in the way he did, to insult the great Brahmin. by putting a snake skin around him. But this was the beginning of the downfall of the Brahmins. This was another symptom of he was a Brahmin. Sringi was the son of a Brahmin. But he acted in a very inimical way. He felt he acted insulted and he cursed a great Rajarishi. So he was another a precursor, forerunner of Kali. The downfall of the Brahminical class is also another symbolic representation of the beginning of Kali Yuga. So at this time, these were the inauspicious signs. Kali Yuga was beginning. The cow was being symbolically tortured. There was only one leg left, the leg of truth. The Brahmins were beginning to fall down and curse the Rajarishis. So in this way, the onset of Kali Yuga was characterized by these people. Now, of course, there are millions of such people everywhere. Dhritarashtra was another person who characterized selfishness. One could say that the whole battle was fought due to the selfishness of Dhritarashtra wanting to put his own sons on the throne over the Pandavas, which they weren't actually entitled to. So he was just so greedy that he wouldn't listen to any good sense. And for the sake of wanting kingdom, not even for himself but for his sons, he was intransigent. He wouldn't reconcile himself. And so there are many Dhritarashtras now all over the world. The Prabhupada comments and purports that there's a Dhritarashtra in every household. He wants his house to be the whole kingdom. He wants his wealth. And even the pauper is proud of his penny. What's that saying? All that glitters is not gold. Everybody is enamored by this. Television is the modern goal, the modern age. Everyone is television. Once we were looking up all the words that started with GL, like glitter and glisten and gleam, to see, and it's a huge number, 40 or 50 words like that. Glamour, glory. Okay. People are attracted to the light. And because gold is a very bright metal, people are instantly attracted to it. When I was 13, I was given a gold ring as a gift, and I used to play the keyboards, and I always took it off because it was so awkward to wear it. And when I took it off one time, I don't know where I was, I just lost it. And my aunt and uncle who gave it to me were absolutely furious. They thought I was completely insane that I could lose a gold ring. Just take it off and throw it down somewhere. Any other questions? Prabhupada wrote to me, he said that ours is a movement of the masses. And his indication was that we should approach anyone and everyone indiscriminately without thinking whether they're rich or poor, and induce them to either chant, hear the philosophy, get some prasadam, or just have some association, try to get a book, and so their spiritual life can begin. Because for most of us, it's really hard to tell who's rich and who's poor, or who's got money, who doesn't have money. We don't know. So it's like you say, everybody is suffering, whether they're rich or poor. And sometimes the people who are rich are suffering more. They're suffering really a lot trying to keep their wealth. So Krishna consciousness is indiscriminate. At the same time, Prabhupada writes that, well, I guess we'll discuss this a bit tomorrow morning, according to time, place, and candidate, we preach. You know, sometimes we you know, try to, just like when we're distributing books, we start a conversation, we immediately try to hear what the person said, try to know where it's coming from, and then we say something else, and then we hear him or her say something else, and then we say something according to that. So that's going on all the time. Sometimes we're speaking according to how we size up a particular person. In that way, we're not, you know, just singling out a certain class of people to preach to. I was just making the point that because we're, this particular temple's in a certain type of neighborhood and we want to reach out to neighbors, it's not just like you can go and bring a cake or something like you can in a lot of places. You know, there's another layer of sophistication that you have to consider. Yeah. Well, that was also another thing. Prabhupada, he was preaching in India. He started, then he came to America because the people in India wouldn't help him. I mean, when he wrote to his friends back in India, he was disappointed that they wouldn't even write letters of support, hardly. They wouldn't release any money. But then when the American following developed to a certain point, he came to India with what he called his white elephants, dancing white elephants. And because he'd come back with success, success breeds success, they say, the people who wouldn't help him in India, they became very struck with wonder that Prabhupada had gone out with nothing and he came back with these Western people, and they were completely amazed. So he was the expert at knowing how to use everything in the service of Krishna. Here's wealth. I'm going to bring all this wealth back to India, put them on the stage, get them dancing. And there was a class in Bombay where all the Westerners were there with Prabhupada. This is shortly after he came back. And he was saying how they're such gentlemen, they don't take they don't take intoxication, no illicit sex, no gambling, no meat eating. And people were really surprised. So one kind of cynical question came. They asked Prabhupada after his class, well, they must go to movies. Maybe, okay, I'll accept that they don't eat meat now, but they must go to movies. Bombay film industry is bigger than Hollywood. And he just couldn't imagine that they wouldn't go to movies. So he was sincerely asking, and Prabhupada's response was, it's not a question of them wanting to go to movies, they hate movies. And everyone was going, yeah, yeah, like that, on the stage. So he could understand that it's really true. He said, it's not, they don't even want to go. They don't go, of course they don't go, but not only they don't go, they don't even want to go. And why don't they want to go? Because they hate movies. That was a real shock, that these people could actually hate movies. The one thing, all right, maybe they're going to give up meat eating and things like that, but to actually hate movies, that was really beyond what he could comprehend. So that was Prabhupada's expertise. He actually made the Americans hate movies and television, which they all watched, all went to. That's really significant. So Prabhupada showed that he could do both. He could, you know, go and captivate the wealthy people, and they come back to India, and with that blind man, blind man philosophy, lame man, blind man, captivated these masses. That was his genius. He knew how to capture everybody through the grace of Lord Chaitanya and Rupa Goswami. And our movement's become very popular in India, very, very, more than any country. Yeah, we'll talk about that tomorrow. There's another book in that series, book on the environment. It's coming out next month. So, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.